Hello, and welcome to the first of a four-part series about liberty and security. This panel discussion was held on March 21, 2002, in Willimantic, Connecticut. It was sponsored by the Northeast Connecticut Green Party. The event was a public forum on the state of civil liberties in the wake of the USA Patriot Act and the ongoing war on terrorism. Speakers were asked to address these issues as they relate to constitutional rights and their effects on Latino immigrants, Arab Americans, and social justice activists.
My name is Donna Nicolino, and I'm a member of the Northeast Connecticut Green Party, which is sponsoring this forum. And the name of this forum is Liberty versus Security. How has the war on terrorism affected our civil liberties? Each of our panelists tonight will explore a different aspect of that question. Each panelist will speak for 12 minutes, and there will be a question and answer period at the end, so we ask that you hold your questions until all of the speakers are finished. This program is being recorded in both audio and video, as well as being broadcast live on a local radio station. If for any reason you do not want to be recorded, but you do want to ask a question, you can write your question down. I left a little notepad out at one of the tables in the lobby. And you can give it to myself, to Dave Nelson, who is our timekeeper, who is sitting right here. Or we were hoping to have a translator, but you can give it to myself or give it to David Nelson, and we will ask your question for you. The issues that are going to be brought up this evening are not going to go away overnight. It will take the concerted effort of many people. If you are concerned about these issues and would like to find out more or take action around them, there will be sign-up sheets going around for those who are interested in meeting with their representatives. And for those interested in attending the march in Washington on April 20th, the Green Party is sponsoring or chartering a bus, and there are some sign-up sheets out in the lobby for that also. I am also going to be passing around a can. For any of you who would like to put in some money for our speakers who have very generously donated their time. There's also a can out on one of the tables that will, the money from which will go to the legal defenses of the people who were arrested in Hartford at an anti-war demonstration in October. Okay. Since September 11th, up to 2,000 Arab American men have been detained and even deported, often without any kind of due process or being able to contact their families or a lawyer. This situation has gotten so bad that the British newspaper, the UK Independent, has likened the detentions to the practice of disappearing people in Latin America. Congress has passed the USA Patriot Act, most of them without actually having read it, which jeopardizes many of the rights we thought were guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. And Attorney General John Ashcroft has stated that to even question these actions is to give comfort to the enemy. However, one could easily disagree and say that one of the most important roles of a citizen in a true democracy is to ask questions and hold our representatives accountable. In fact, as abolitionist Wendell Phillips once said, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Hopefully this forum will help answer some of the questions you have, and hopefully it will raise even more. And our first speaker is going to be Azam Saeed. Azam is a former Air Force pilot from Pakistan and is now a U.S. citizen. He has held management positions in Europe as well as the United States with a number of multinational corporations. His education is in physics, and he also holds a master's degree in business administration from the University of Michigan Business School. His civic work has been with organizations such as Amnesty International and UNICEF. Four of the world's largest religions are represented within his immediate family. He lives in Farmington with his wife, Dr. Aisha Saeed.
Thank you, Donna, for that kind introduction. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here this evening. I should first of all mention the reason I'm here. When Donna called me and requested me to speak here, I said on this subject, Donna, do you realize that I tend to be a Republican voting conservative, and I actually voted for George Bush in 2000. Donna said, hey, don't worry about that. We'll call you an activist, and all your sins will be forgiven. So I'm really here for redemption. And Donna has asked me to talk about this subject from two angles. One is the balance between security and liberty, and the second one is the international angle to this situation and crisis we face, especially in regards to the U.S. foreign policy. There are two handouts I have I should just point out. I'll try to cover some of this information, but one is about who created Al-Qaeda, why and how, words of Zbigniew Brzezinski and Professor Iqbal Ahmed, just a one-sheet handout. And the second thing I have to understand how things function in our world is once again, a one-sheet ABC News report about something called Operation Northwoods. And so for those of you who have not heard about Operation Northwoods, I would strongly recommend that you take a copy of this, and it gives a very good picture of how things work, even in countries or societies called democratic otherwise. Let me begin using the words of William Douglas, U.S. Supreme Court Justice from 1939 to 1975. Quote, "As nightfall does not come at once, neither does oppression. There is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged, and it is in such a twilight that we must be most aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness," end quote. Having lived under three martial law regimes, even at the risk of sounding arrogant, I would say that I have a fairly good idea of what Justice Douglas is talking about. The debate in our media about enhancing security within the United States hovers around the model that liberty and security are mutually exclusive, and we need to give up some liberty to get some more security. It seems that the only question to ask is, how much liberty need we give up to become more secure? What has not been highlighted in the media is the viewpoint that the two, that is security and liberty, are not mutually exclusive. They certainly do not have an inverse mutual relationship on the same dimension. Benjamin Franklin conveyed the point clearly, quote, "Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety," end quote. Another point our media has conveniently ignored is that the current paradigm is regressive and falls flat on its face if taken a couple of steps further. What if there is another terrorist attack on the U.S. soil? Would we give up some more liberty then? What if there is yet another attack despite giving up even more liberties? Would we then be willing to live in a police state? Many experts are very emphatic on this subject. Frank Anderson, the former head of CIA's Middle East operations, was questioned by Mike Wallace sometime in November, I believe, in a 60 Minutes broadcast about how much civil liberty we need to give up. Anderson did not mince his words. Quote, "Absolutely none. If we cannot handle this problem without surrendering our civil liberties, our constitutional freedoms, then I do not want to live in this country," end quote. Now, I'm sure other speakers will talk about the secrecy surrounding the detentions and all of the proceedings that are going on in this country vis-a-vis people who have been detained or arrested. I would like to talk about secrecy from a different angle, and that is the angle of policy in terms of what has been conveyed to the people about why things are the way they are from a very broad perspective. And we should realize that all of the secrecy accompanying this situation also has an implication for our democratic maxim that ours is a government of the people, for the people, by the people. How dear do we hold this maxim, and even what do we mean by democracy is the question. Abraham Lincoln enunciated the philosophical foundation of our concept of democracy succinctly. Quote, "I am a firm believer in the people. If given the truth, they can be depended upon to meet any national crisis. The great point is to bring them the real facts," end quote. So in order to neutralize the threats we face internally and externally, we need to understand them a little more deeply. And we should try to figure out how such threats come into being. Let's ask ourselves the question, who created Al-Qaeda? And my experience has been that 99% of the people in this country would not be able to answer that question adequately or accurately at all. The answer may be disturbing and even depressing to most, but finally knowing the truth is a liberating experience. And my hope for this evening is that all of us here would know who created Al-Qaeda by the end of this session. This knowledge may finally lead us to realize what the rest of the world has been trying to tell us for a long time about our own foreign policy. Thus, information about what's going on and what the government has found out is an essential part of our national decision-making process. It may be worth reminding ourselves that secrecy is antithesis to democracy, and the excuse of national security is often just that, an excuse. In November 2001, President George Bush signed an executive order that allows either a sitting or past president to block access to White House papers. This order reverses a 1978 law emanating from the Watergate scandal, which allowed U.S. citizens access to presidential papers 12 years after the term of office finished. In a piece in the Christian Science Monitor, Pat Holt, former chief of staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, elaborated, quote, "Some of these new executive orders have nothing to do with terrorism. An example is assertion of a presidential right to overrule both Congress and prior presidents to prevent the release of presidential papers. President Bush argues non-existent constitutional powers, a thin and insupportable ground, nor is there any reason. One therefore has to look for hidden reasons," end quote. 100 Nobel laureates made a statement a few months ago, three months ago, that was largely ignored by our mainstream media. Among other things, it said the following, quote, "It is time to turn our backs on the unilateral search for security in which we seek to shelter behind walls. To survive in the world we have transformed, we must learn to think in a new way," end quote. And when we start thinking in a new way, the types of questions we should begin with would be the following, in my viewpoint. Why 9/11? Why did it happen? Why is it that 99% of people in this country do not have a good idea of who created Al-Qaeda? Why is it that 99% of this people in this country do not realize to an adequate extent what all goes on in our name all over the world? And when we answer those questions, we will come to another link that is crucial, and that is the role of our mainstream media in the way things work. And so when we try to answer these questions, we should also look at the role and realize how our mainstream media plays a role in keeping us unaware and innocent. To conclude, the economic and political power play in the world is a complex phenomenon. It is not a battle between good and evil, and it is certainly not a battle where any one side is consistently on the side of good. Developing some understanding of this complexity would go a long way in our ability to be secure and simultaneously retain our abilities. When we look around the globe, we realize that the world's history has not seen a nation stronger than the United States. Militarily, or economically. It may also be worth noting that a strong and honorable democratic nation faces no threat to its security and liberty more serious than its own collective innocence and unawareness. Do I have a couple more minutes to... two more minutes. I'll quickly go over, and I could go into more details if need be, but here's what Professor Iqbal Ahmed has to say about who created Al-Qaeda. Late Iqbal Ahmed said all of this, most of this, in a lecture he delivered in 1998, so prophetic and prescient words. And he was from Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. He died in 1999. Quote, "What happened in Afghanistan has not been discussed in the West. When the Soviet Union intervened in Afghanistan, the U.S. saw it as an opportunity that was twofold. One, they hoped to tie up the Soviet Union in a Vietnam-like war in Afghanistan itself. Two, which becomes more important later on, they saw an opportunity to mobilize the entire Muslim world in a violent way against the Soviet Union, against communism. In an effort to mobilize the entire Muslim world against the evil empire, the CIA started supporting the flow of volunteers from all around the world to fight in Afghanistan, to be socialized into the ideology of anti-communism, and to be trained to hit communists wherever they found them. That's how the militants were recruited and flown in. I've seen plane loads of them arriving from Algeria, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, even from Palestine, where at that time Israel was supporting Hamas against al-Fatah, Yasser Arafat's faction of the PLO. These people were brought in, given an ideology, and told that armed struggle is virtuous, and the whole notion of jihad as an international pan-Islamic movement was born. The U.S. has spent billions in producing the bin Ladens of our time. In 1986, I visited the camp they hit in Zawahar, Afghanistan in 1998. It was a CIA-sponsored camp. The United States did not withdraw their support from bin Laden and others. They continued their support." I have some more. If there are questions, I'll go into more details. Thank you.
You were listening to a panel discussion on civil liberties following the September 11th calamity. The event took place in Willimantic, Connecticut on March 21st, 2002.
Our next speaker is Teresa Younger. Teresa Younger is the executive director of the Connecticut Civil Liberties Union. She is the first woman and African-American executive director in the 50-plus years of the CCLU. Teresa is not a lawyer, but comes to the CCLU with nearly 10 years' experience in nonprofit management, youth development, program development, and fundraising. Prior to joining the CCLU, Teresa was employed with Changing Our World Incorporated, a philanthropic services consulting firm headquartered in New York City. Teresa's past work and personal experiences assist her in her quest to lead the CCLU and its nearly 5,000 statewide members into the next round of battles to preserve individual civil liberties and actively defend the freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
Thank you very much. I think it's important to read my bio because I think people's perception of the ACLU is that it's a whole bunch of left-wingers or that it's a whole bunch of lawyers. And oftentimes, members of the ACLU are the common everyday citizen who are passionately concerned about preserving the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States. And so it's with much enjoyment that I accepted this position 8 months ago. And little did I know when I accepted the position, the state of the world we would be in today. So I walked into it as an activist on many levels, but had no concept what we would be facing politically, nationally, and here in Connecticut. I think it's important as we move forward, I'm going to be speaking on some of the concerns around the USA Patriot Bill. I want to point out a couple of things. I want to let you know again what is said in the Bill of Rights, because I think we get the lesson in eighth grade, if we still get the lesson anymore in eighth grade, and then we almost forget about it, and then somebody might bring it up in way. But the First Amendment says, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of press or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances." That's the First Amendment. The Fourth Amendment, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, homes, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause supported by oath and affirmation, and particularly describing the place of to be searched and the person and things to be seized. I want to just mention one more of these wonderful Bill of Rights that we have here that were put together. Little did they know now then what we were in now. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously asserted by law, and to be informed by the nature and cause of accusations, can be confirmed with a witness against him, can have compulsory process for obtaining witness of his favor, and have assistance of counsel for his defense. That being said, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the USA Patriot Bill. Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU National Office, said, "Terror by its very nature is intended to not only kill and destroy. Terror is also designed to intimidate the people and force them to take actions that may Terror is designed to intimidate a people and force them to take actions that may not be in their long-term best interests. If we allow our freedoms to be undermined, the terrorists will have won." Briefly after September 11th, many of you will recall that Congress got together and put together a piece of legislation called the USA Patriot Bill. The formal title of this bill is called Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. Quite a title. And in 6 weeks, they got that together. In 6 weeks, they got it together, and people, majority of the people in those rooms, agreed that this was a good bill. And we should note a little bit of the history of the bill. The USA Patriot Bill, portions of that bill had been introduced to Congress time and time and time again and had been turned away as being too draconian. They said, no, we won't even bring it up for discussion. Yet, on September 13th, when discussion around the USA Patriot Bill began behind closed doors, it was introduced again, pulled off the shelf, dusted off, and reintroduced as absolutely needed by the Congress in order to protect the American people. This is an attempt, and it's happened in the past, where government doesn't inform the people fully, but takes action in their best interest. Historically, we've overreacted and violated constitutional principles. We don't have to go back so far, but we all do this in the guise of national security. We'll recall World War I, when in its aftermath, people were sent to prison for criticizing the war effort. Demonstrators were subjected to the infamous Palmer raids, where labor organizers and dissenters were systematically rounded up and jailed without arraignment, hearings, or access to attorneys. Just a quick relation. There's a group called the Hartford 18 who were protesting the efforts, who were quickly rounded up, detained, and without counsel, were charged. And now they're in the process of going through that cycle. Interesting. In World War II, we sent 110,000 Japanese Americans to detention camps. Boy, we have something like 2,000 or 3,000 American citizens or longtime residents being detained across this country, and I believe Ashcroft has mentioned he'd like to call in another 3,000 for questioning. The fear of communism created by Senator McCarthy created the Red Scare and guilt by association. Interestingly enough, in 1956, In God We Trust became the motto. It was added to the Pledge of Allegiance and to the oath. God all of a sudden entered into these places because we didn't want to be perceived as a godless constitution, as a godless country. Yet we are seeing in this very state legislation to mandate putting In God We Trust motto signs in every single classroom, mandating on a statewide level that the Pledge of Allegiance be said every day. The Oklahoma bombing resurrected anti-terrorism legislation that had been shelved by Congress as too draconian back then. It became law within 2 weeks of the tragedy and almost completely eliminated the right of habeas corpus. And quickly after the events of September 11th, 6 weeks after the events of September 11th, the USA Patriot Bill was passed. Interestingly enough, 66 representatives voted against the USA Patriot Bill, and one senator voted against the USA Patriot Bill. You almost can't get this majority of people to agree that the sky is blue without about 8 months of debate, and yet we quickly ran in to say that the USA Patriot Bill was needed and necessary. Let me just give you a quick rundown of what some of our concerns are, and then I'll be available to answer some questions. First off, it gives sweeping new powers of detention and surveillance to the executive branch of the government and law enforcement agencies, and depriving the courts of meaningful judicial oversight to ensure that law enforcement powers are not being abused. In fact, warrants can be issued without probable cause, something mentioned in our own Bill of Rights. It gives the Secretary of State the authority to designate any group, foreign or domestic, as a terrorist organization, an authority that is not subject to review. It creates a broad new crime called domestic terrorism, which is defined as, in Section 802 as activities that involves dangerous acts to human life that are in violation of criminal laws of any of the United States or of any state, appear to be intended to intimidate or coerce a civilian population, to influence the policy of government by intimidation or coercion, or to affect the conduct of government by mass destruction, assassination, and kidnapping. This broad definition would include activities that no reasonable person would consider terrorist activities and go so far as to include criminal acts like computer hacking, vandalism, and other low-level crimes. Even the protesters of the AA case, Greenpeace, and PETA could be seen as domestic terrorists. Heaven forbid we consider groups like our own union groups or our own political groups that might have been active during the 1960s. It permits investigations based on lawful First Amendment activity if the activity is tied somehow to intelligence purposes. This bill would permit the FBI to conduct searches and secretly record telephone conversations for the purpose of investigating domestic crime, even if the FBI cannot meet the probable cause standard. It undermines the privacy protections of the Fourth Amendment by eroding the line between intelligence gathering and gathering evidence for criminal proceedings. It expands the ability of the government to spy through wiretaps, computer surveillance, access to medical, financial, business, and educational records, and allows secret searches of homes and offices. These secret searches are called sneak and peek searches and will be done without the knowledge of the person being searched until after the fact. It undermines a fair due process and granted by the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments, and extends to non-citizens all over the country. It extends to non-citizens, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that they do not have due process. Non-citizens can be arrested and held until deported if they are members or have raised funds for or have provided some kind of material support to an organization designated by the Secretary of State as a terrorist organization. It allows non-citizens to be ordered and deported, and if no country will take them, they can remain in the United States detained indefinitely. Individuals believed to be members of foreign terrorist organizations or of any group publicly endorses terrorist acts, as well as their spouse, children, or anybody else may be denied entry into the United States under this act without any proof. Just very quickly, I'm going to run through one or two more things that this bill does. It's a little bit scary. Law enforcement no longer has to prove through probable cause that they need a search warrant. Instead of knocking at your door and saying, we have a search warrant and want to come in and search A, B, and C, they can come in and do that. They can surveil your computer and your telephone without access or without telling you. They can have access to things that I call our really personal files, those files we don't discuss with anybody else. We barely get the words out to our husband or spouses or significant others. Things like what our educational background was, all those nitty-gritty details, our medical and financial and mental health and other personal records are completely open. And all of this is if the Secretary of State deems he needs this information. Americans engaging in civil disobedience or other form of protest activity can be charged with domestic terrorism. And this act expands the range of computer crimes defined as terrorist offenses and penalties attached to them. I just want to make a quick reference before we continue on about what's happening in Hartford ourselves. There was a piece of legislation that expanded wiretapping. There was a piece of legislation put out to allow a state crime of terrorism with an incredibly broad definition attached to it. We have seen legislation to introduce, as I mentioned before, the Pledge of Allegiance and In God We Trust. We have seen a Homeland Security bill that goes so far as to wrap up the fact that they will tell you when you need to be vaccinated. You have no option about whether you want to be or whether your children will be, and what the quarantine efforts will be after that happens. These are bills that we're seeing on a statewide level that are being followed through on a national level. I'm getting the high five sign, and I have left in the back a fact sheet that's called the USA Patriot Bill fact sheet, and we encourage you all to please pick up that fact sheet, and when we open the floor for conversation and questions, I welcome conversation and questions. Thank you very much.
So concludes this part of a series on liberty and security after the September 11th calamity. Please tune in again for part two. This program was produced by George King at the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. Sound engineering was by John Schwenk. The music used in this program was composed by Dominic Muldowney. Thanks for listening.